Hi, and welcome to Shifters Podcast. Today's guest is corporate innovation expert Dan Thoma. He's the co-author of The Corporate Startup. But most importantly, he will be speaking at the Shift conference November 14th. And welcome, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've actually met once before, or twice before, actually. But the first time you were actually speaking in Norway. And
yeah, I think it was 2014 or 2015 or...
I think 16.
16? Yeah. You guys just started. By the way, congratulations. You grew so much from that time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I remember we did an article on you, and you said that the most important metric should be for companies to see if they're actually innovating is going after, revenue on a news business unit you haven't had in 3 years or something like that.
Basically measuring how much of your current revenue comes from ideas that you launched in the past, 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years, depending on your appetite for growth. And that was that I still stand by those words 3 years, 2 years later, right? And I still believe it's a good metric for companies to go by to assess if they are actually moving the needle in terms of growth.
But I actually disagree with you a little bit on that.
Okay.
Because it's a good metric, but it doesn't differentiate whether it's like incremental innovation or substantial or disruptive innovation, right?
It's a very good point, and it's not just that, but if you were to institutionalize that particular metric in your organization, you're going to end up with your costs going up because you're going to have more distribution costs, more marketing costs, more development costs. So it's like a two-edged knife, right? On one side, yes, it's a good metric to go by. On the other hand, it depends very much on how you frame it.
Exactly.
Exactly what you just put it.
Yeah. But still, it's better than most metrics that businesses are using today. But let's get into it. We're going to talk about corporate innovation. And first of all, how do you define corporate innovation?
It's a very good question. I think I've actually spent a lot of time defining it. In general, I define innovation, and I define innovation as a novelty, a new thing, wrapped up in a sustainable business model, in a business model that can actually exist by itself and survive, pretty much like the startups, right? They have a great idea, and then they create a sustainable business model, and they just go with it.
So does the business model have to be new? Is that
the no, not part? Necessarily the business model needs to be new. So you have to have something new in terms of a new value proposition or a new way in which you deliver it. Again, what's very important is the sustainability part.
Is it innovation if you're doing something that someone else is doing?
It can be. It can very well be. Depends again what is the market in which you're putting. If that particular market hasn't seen much of that, definitely is innovation for that particular market. If you are just a copycat in the same exact market, probably you're not very innovative.
Okay, but I say, but it because innovation is it. Who is the recipient of innovation? Is it like the society or is it the business? Because for the business, it might be innovation, right? To do
right.
it.
No.
But is it like from the society's level? Oh, no, this is not innovation. We already have this solution.
So, yeah, I was thinking more in terms of like the society and the recipients of that product. Because for a lot of companies which are like traditional, right? They might just claim that everything is innovation because they haven't done much. Like take for example, oil and gas companies. Now they're faced with change, right? They're faced with renewables. They're faced with other things that they haven't done before. But as a society and other companies, they've been doing it for quite some time now.
Yeah.
So it's basically the question is new to company or new to your market segment or new to society. Yeah. And I would call it basically new to society.
So if you copy an idea from another market, then you're an innovative.
it's all about framing, I guess, right? Yeah. So you can always talk about like Rocket Internet. Is Rocket Internet an innovative company, right? On one hand, you can say yes for the people in Philippines, for people in Malaysia, they might be an innovative company. For the people in San Francisco, they are just a copycat.
Yeah, but they actually their innovation is the copycat.
Is
being the best copycat, right?
I don't think nobody actually spent the time to define copycat innovation.
No.
We can actually patent that term, me and you. And
yeah, because a lot of problems with innovation is that you don't have problem solution fit or product market fit, right? But if you, let's say you see it in another market, it's much easier to implement, like do it, because it's been actually validated in some sort of way in a different market.
In a different market, yeah.
But indeed. Still you have, your market is not necessarily the same one, right? So
It's a very hairy question, and it's very difficult to say what innovation actually is. And again, I think it's all a matter of your frame of reference. All right. So if your frame of reference is quite wide, is worldwide, it's very hard to be totally innovative. But because, you know, we're talking about the population of 7 billion, most of the things have been invented. But then again, if you're changing your frame of reference and now you're talking about a certain village, you might just be very innovative just introducing internet.
And just not to lose that, because I think this is really interesting. This with startups and corporates, are startups innovative, or can't they be innovative because they're inherently, they have, like, they're based on building something new, so they're not innovating from something old, right?
Yeah.
So can they be innovative?
Sure. I think startups are probably more innovative than large organizations, because unlike large organizations, they don't have a core business, which has like a massive gravitational pull, pulling in like resources and time and, you know, like people. On the other hand, it's very paradoxical that, these large organizations, on one hand, they have a lot of resources, but they find it very hard to create something new. And, the paradox comes with the fact that startups, they don't dispose of those resources, but then they are very good at creating new stuff. So I...
Yeah, but isn't the art of innovation, isn't that going from something to something new? But the startups is going from nothing, so it's much easier to go to...
They're not constrained anyway, right? So exactly. for them, it's pretty much very, very easy to pivot, very, very easy to change. If you uncover the fact that, well, actually, this market doesn't want this particular product, I would just jump into a new market or a new industry altogether, whether a bank or an airline company. It's very difficult for them to say, well, we realize that nobody wants airlines anymore and we're going to do Facebook for dogs. And
yeah, exactly. The pivot. Yeah. You don't see a lot of pivots in big corps, right?
There's a lot of reasons behind that. And of course, it's very difficult when you have that gravitational pull of the core, but also it's very difficult because there are other systems in place that prevent pivoting. For example, budgeting, right? Budgeting is probably one of the most archaic systems that organizations have. Basically, when I give you that amount of money to deliver that particular X, I actually expect an X at the end of the 6 months or 12 months runway I gave you, regardless of the evidence that you uncovered along the way, proving the fact that nobody wants an X and they want a Y. Yeah. So again, the way standard budgeting works at the moment, being tied to budgeting cycles, again, the budgeting that organizations have at the moment is very well in line with core business and incremental innovation. But once you want to do something from zero, once you want to do something from scratch and outside your core, then the system that actually helped you become better in your core is actually hindering you from achieving anything outside of it.
Yeah, exactly. There are two totally different modes of operating, right? So
exactly.
One is exploration, like you put it, and the other one is more of execution, right?
More execution. I basically say that most of the organizations nowadays are, not nowadays, but they've been very good at innovation for almost 100 years. If you work for a company that's 100 plus years old, that company's been very good at innovation. Yes, the type of innovation that they've been good at is incremental. And I think one of the things that that people need to wrap their heads around is the fact that innovation should not be used as a one size fits all word, right? Whenever you ask people, what do you do? Why do you innovation? Well, try to define what that type of innovation is. Is it incremental, breakthrough, or disruptive? Because just by saying people are not good at innovation, you're not doing a favor to anybody. As I said, large organizations are good. It's just that the thing that they are good at is incremental. And the problem for them is that the world is changing at an exponential rate, at an exponential step, and their only solution is linear. So you're trying to solve an exponential problem with a linear solution. Obviously, you're going to lose.
Yeah, Why can't we just call incremental innovation for improvement?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple words for that. It's incremental, it's core, it's, as you said, improvement.
That's what it is, right? It's just an improvement.
It is.
Because it's something that you actually, it's just a tweak on the product you already have.
Yeah, and it's a good point. A lot of organizations miss the fact that this is actually the fact. Miss the fact that their innovation is just incremental, and sometimes they go down the road of explaining their digital transformation efforts as innovation transformation, and actually digital transformation is not an innovation transformation. It's basically a way in which you prevent your business models to expire in the near future, and you're ensuring that they will expire in the medium to long future.
Yeah.
But you're actually not preventing those business models from expiring in any way, or you're not creating new business models to take the load off the old ones.
Yeah, I'm just imagining now in my head a boat going towards a waterfall, and you're improving the boat, so the boat becomes a little bit better, but it's still gonna go down the waterfall, right? So what you actually should do is making a parachute or a plane. I don't know if that's a good image, but you're constantly improving and it becomes better. It keeps you afloat, but you don't see the big waterfall.
You're basically plugging the holes, but the waterfall, as you just said, is just ahead.
Yeah, and I think that waterfall actually is a good metaphor because of the waterfall method.
Yeah, I never thought of it, but
no,
you're
right. I just thought of it right now, and it's possibly about the. But anyway, we have the innovation definition out of the way. What are the essential steps to be able to actually innovate, not improve, but to innovate substantially in a big organization?
Yeah, I think it's a very big question, right? Yeah. And obviously,
could you break it down? Like, what are the four steps? Maybe
depending on who you're talking to, they're going to give you different answers. I'm going to give you mine. Again, I don't believe in any way that these are the ones, but these are just my personal take on that. I think it's very important for the organizations to be aligned top down. So people at the top of the organization, depending how big the organization is, they all need to be aligned on the need for innovation and the goals. After everybody's aligned and they have an ethos for innovation, right? They go, yeah, we want to do this. I think it's very important to tie innovation to their core business goals. Because I've seen a lot of organizations that innovation is just happening as an island in the sun, if you want, right? It's just out there, done by others. We're not going to touch it. And we still have our own core business, our cash cow to milk. So I think that's a big mistake. And I think that innovation should be there to reinforce and to support core business goals, right? And should be there to support your company's vision and your company's growth ambition.
So what is a core business goal of, for example, Hewlett Packard, like the computer maker?
It's a very good question. I personally haven't analyzed the annual report of Hewlett Packard, but I'm sure that like with every major organization, they have really clear growth goals and really clear ambitions. And innovation should be just there to support those on top of the core business. So the core business can pull its weight to a point, and then you have innovation taking over from that point onwards.
Yes, but I'm trying to apply this on, let's say, Apple.
Yeah.
Would like the things they did, like you're making a music player, that probably wouldn't be considered core business at the time.
Sure.
Would it? But it's still a very innovative move.
Yeah.
To do so.
I think the iPod launch, right? If you go back 10 years, you're going to see that.
20 years, actually. No, 18 years.
18 years, yeah, almost. Oh my God, we're so old, right?
Yeah.
I think the iPhone is 10 years old.
That's correct, yeah. Almost. 11 years, yeah.
11 years, yeah, because they launched the X last year. In terms of launching the iPod and even the iPhone, right, I think what they were supporting growth. So they were supporting their growth targets with that new move. And of course, their core business was supporting growth to some extent. And then following that particular boundary, they needed to move into new markets with new ideas in order to sustain that growth. the problem that most organizations have is that that growth is viewed as a percentage, right? So the bigger you are, the more difficult it's going to be for you to achieve your growth goals, because it's one thing to have 1% of a company like Apple, and it's another one, it's another thing to have a 1% growth of a company like, you know,
our shifter,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Like your company.
Yeah.
Your company can achieve the 1% goal. Apple is going to be quite difficult to achieve their 1% year-on-year goal.
Yeah.
So that's actually an issue with growth that is viewed in percentage. And then if you go and talk about banking now, if you talk about financial industries, if you go and talk about other regulated markets, you're going to find the problem is even higher and even bigger, right? More difficult to solve, because a lot of these organizations are forced by law to have a certain number of assets on their books, right? And then growth is viewed as growth percentage of the assets that you have on your books. So the more assets you have, the more difficult it's going to be for you to achieve those goals. But
yeah,
then they're regulated.
But like back to the core product thing. So yeah. Do you think it's growth a core like, is that core growth? Is that how you view?
I think that growth is an overarching theme for the entire organization.
Yeah.
Right. And growth is actually not. I mean. At least in my opinion, growth should not be viewed as an end goal, but it should be viewed as a byproduct of doing something that customers want and customers need, right? So emphasize what the customers want, not your growth targets. Your growth targets is going to be just a byproduct of you creating a good product or serving a good market.
Yeah, I agree. And the same with innovation. It's not the goal in itself, right? It should support something, right?
Exactly.
Like it should bring you more money in some sort of way in down the line, right?
Yeah.
But you said that in order, like you believe that you should, like the innovation effort should support the core business.
Yeah, they should be aligned, because the core is definitely utilizing a lot of assets, and the core actually has a good competitive position. And I think innovation should be there to either reinforce that or use that for growth. Use that as a springboard for whatever it is they want to achieve. So not just view it as like, this is innovation and the other thing is core, but more like, how can these things play together?
Yeah, but back to Apple.
Sure, sure.
Back to Apple. But do you consider the iPod an innovation on the core of Apple at that time?
No. When they launched it was definitely a if you want an adjacency, but I think it was actually a transformational move from Apple. Yeah. But as time progressed, that kind of like, and the idea matured, that kind of like became their core business, right? And now they need to create, it's basically like a cycle, right? So everything that you put now into transformational efforts, over time, they're going to become your core, and your original core will probably die off.
Okay, so you're not like super religious about having to innovate on the core?
No, in general, I'm not very, very dogmatic about that. As I said, probably it was misinterpreted in one way, or I was not able to express it properly, but the idea is to utilize core and align your strategy with your innovation strategy with the overall growth strategy.
Yeah.
Or at least not the overall growth strategy, but with the overall growth goals.
Yeah. So you put a lot of emphasis on the formal structure, top down.
I say it's very important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And but you also have the informal structure in the company, right?
Sure.
Like culture. Which
yeah.
will actually fight against this in many many times. How do you manage to overcome the cultural barrier?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and of course there's a lot of experts out there on culture. I don't consider myself to be an expert on culture, but from my personal observation and from my personal experience, I realized that actually a culture is developed over time and is developed through the use of processes. So the more a process is utilized, the more the process is enforced and policed, the more that process is going to become a culture. So at one point, you will no longer need that process. It's just going to be the culture of that particular organization. You know, there's this saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast. or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I heard a very anecdotal rephrase of that. And the question was, why doesn't culture and strategy have breakfast together?
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's actually the goal, to have a culture that is supporting your strategy and vice versa.
Yeah, but the culture is, like you said, it's based, let's say the culture is based on the processes, and it just becomes the way of doing things in the company, right?
Culture follows process. That's my personal stand on it.
But is your opinion then, if you change the process, you will change the culture?
Yes. I believe that for changing culture, you need to start by changing your processes first, and then do all the other things that need to happen in order to change culture. Again, I'm not a culture expert. I don't know what are those things.
No.
But start with process, and not just start with process, but once you agree on a process, then enforce it and make sure that the process is playing out in the way in which you actually envisioned it.
That's very interesting. I think you have a very interesting view, because you're very formalistic on your you believe in the power of the process and structure and organization. I think that's very fascinating, actually.
I come from an engineering background, so
yes.
I'm hardwired like that.
Yeah. Okay. And yes, because I have a different view than you. I'm a political scientist background. I've studied like organizations, and I've witnessed through the research how important culture is. Like it can either like be something that helps the formal structure, or it could be actually something that weakens the form, like destroys the formal structure.
I totally agree with you. Mm. Like that's something that is just not debatable. I think culture is a very important aspect of any organization, big or small. And again, I think culture is sometimes misunderstood. And I believe that culture doesn't necessarily mean the people that you want to have a beer with, but or the people you want to hang out with, but more like the people that you share the same values and the same expectations, right? Yeah. With, I think that's actually a definition of culture. But in order to get there, obviously you can start recruiting people that fit, but you can't recruit, you can't fire your entire organization and rehire everybody.
No.
So what do you do with those people? Like, obviously you need to start, you know, like shifting them towards what you want the company to be. And I believe that the only way to do it is for process change, because you know, weekends at the seaside, well, they're good, but they're not going to change our culture that much.
No, I agree. And you mentioned it, that it should be in the core, not on the side. And a lot of companies are actually outsourcing or putting the innovation outside the business.
That's one of the biggest mistakes that the company.
Why is that a big mistake?
Because it's just setting up the premise for the wrong narratives to evolve. And some of the wrong narratives I've seen, and they're wrong attitudes, were the not invented here syndrome. Because at one point, those things that were created on the side.
What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. So the things that were created outside the mothership, right? The things that were created outside the mothership, at one point, they need to find a home in the mothership. And if those people that created them, they don't work with the people in the mothership, then the people in the mothership will have absolutely no interest in adopting those ideas, no matter how good they are, because they're going to say, well, not invented here. Yeah. I was not involved in this. I could have done it better. Another wrong behavior that's triggering is
that's the culture, right?
That's
definitely meeting the culture. But can you just change that with the processes inside the mother company?
If your process would say we're going to build it together with the people in the core, or the people in innovation have a floor at the same building as the people in the core business, then probably it would be easier for them to relate to one another, right? Oh, I know John working in innovation, or I know Mary working in core, because it just happened that we both had coffee this morning, or we're waiting in line at the same coffee shop in front of the building.
Yeah.
Another narrative that's fairly wrong and triggered by the idea of having innovation outside is it's not innovation is not my job. Right, so the people in core would be like, "Oh, it's not my job to innovate," and actually, innovation is everybody's job. And no matter if you work in audit, in compliance, or in product development, innovation is definitely your job. We're talking about forms of innovation and types of innovation, right? We just started this conversation with incremental improvement and then disruptive and breakthrough innovation. Innovation is everybody's job. Some people might just do more incremental and less disruptive. Some people will do more disruptive and less incremental. And another thing that that's very, very dangerous when you have an innovation function outside of your you know, like mothership organization is the us versus them narrative, right? If people cannot connect to one another, they're going to start referring to the other people as them and us, right? And we are always better than them, no matter which perspective you're going to have on things, no matter which side you're going to take in this conversation, is going to be always us versus them. And there were a lot of companies that that failed, and I think probably the most notable one was Yahoo with their brick house in San Francisco. They were basically the pioneers of the idea of, oh, we need to have a corporate innovation function. And they set up the brick house. It was called the brick house because that was actually in a brick house in downtown San Francisco. And then the offices of Yahoo were outside. And despite all the efforts and despite all the successes actually that the brick house had in terms of product development, in terms of success and market success and whatnot, they were still discontinued for the cultural reason. People didn't agree in the core. So people at the Yahoo office did not agree with the need of a brick house and whatnot. And then people in the brick house were viewing the other ones as either lazy, or they view them as, defenders of the status quo. Again, totally, totally wrong narrative, totally wrong conversation. And
so do you believe, because here he puts emphasis on the culture perspective, actually.
Yeah.
So do you believe that the culture will be stronger to, it's harder to penetrate when it's perceiving something from outside coming in than rather than changing from within the company itself?
I believe so. I believe that the innovation department, right, or your innovation functions should stay where your core is, for people to be able to relate to the products that those people are launching, and for the people in the innovation department to relate to where does the money come from. Because obviously in every large organization, the innovation department is a cost center, yeah, right? Those money come from somebody or from somewhere. Well, you need to be able to understand where the money comes from. Yeah. Oh, it's the folks at level five, right? The people that are sitting the floor beneath us, that they are providing with all the money that we have for like 3D printing and all the other experiments that we've done. And the people at level five should be like, oh yeah, I understand where my money is going. It's going to the folks upstairs. And by the way, let's just go and see what they're working on. Right, so you're bridging that gap, and again, this is by design. This is by process. This is not random.
No, yeah, I agree. Yes. So, so what are the most difficult thing with like implementing an innovation strategy in the company and actually executing on it? Yeah, that is a big question. But like, what do you see as like typical issues?
That's again, it's a very big question. I think that of course, in this answer, we're going to oversimplify and generalize stuff, but I think every single company has their own way of struggling with this, if you want, right? We touched upon budgeting at one point, right? We said that budgeting needs to change, because budgeting the way it's done currently is definitely not allowing for a lot of pivots, a lot of change, which is something that innovation requires, right? Another one is, as I said, alignment with the growth goals of the company. Most of the time, is just innovation is just viewed as a distraction if there's no alignment. Then, of course, a big one and one of my favorite is how do you measure innovation? Right? We're very good at measuring our core business, and we know how to manage by numbers. Well, show me the numbers for innovation, and then it's going to be easier for me to back those initiatives. There's so many things that again, every single organization has their own way of struggling with this. We in the corporate startup, we divide activities basically on strategy, practice, and management. And depending on where organization is in terms of maturity on the journey from we don't do any innovation to we're very good, your bottlenecks can be in different parts. Some people will struggle with the fact that they have no trained folks to work on innovation, where some people will say, well, we have a lot of trained folks working on innovation, but our middle management is fairly poor in terms of understanding innovation. So maybe that's your bottleneck.
Yeah. So one key aspect, as I see it, as you have to be ready for innovation in a company before you start to innovate, right?
Yeah.
And lots of companies are like, they're actually the same companies, but then they say, okay, we're trying to innovate, but things will go wrong because you don't have best practice. You don't actually know what you're doing. You don't have the, like the thesis you're talking about. And what if someone had a good idea in the company, and what is the process for making that good idea into a business? A lot of companies don't have that. It's exactly. Like, okay, if you have a good idea, okay, talk to your manager, and he will talk to, like, you know, it's a very informal route. It's not a formal process, right?
That's actually the problem. The problem is that it's most of the time is totally informal. And it's totally driven by luck, if you want, to some extent. And the narrative I always give to especially executive teams that I'm working with, I always say that imagine your company as a system, right? The average output, the output that you're seeing in your company is the average output of the best players and the worst players in your company. That's your average. By institutionalizing innovation, by having a clear framework, a clear step-by-step approach to what you do, a clear governance, if you want, right? A clear governance system for innovation, you are not going to increase the output or the performance of your best players, because those are already peak performing, right? What you're going to do, you're going to increase the performance of your worst players, right? Or the people that don't have those personal traits in order to make stuff happen, and they expect there's a system for them to work with or work in. And by increasing the value of your worst players, you're actually increasing the overall average of your output. So it's very important to have a system. And I'm always giving the metaphor of football teams, right? I don't know if you're a Barcelona or a Real Madrid fan. I personally like Barcelona, and I'll say that Barcelona wins not because of the Messi. Barcelona doesn't win because of a player. Barcelona wins because they play a system. And not just that, but they have an entire ecosystem of players, right? And an entire ecosystem of activities. How do they scout? How do they train? How do they coach? How do they recuperate players, right? Barcelona is able to turn out Messi's every 10 years. And that's where Barcelona is very good at. And that's the difference between a team like Barcelona or Real Madrid or Chelsea, if you want, and tier B teams. Yeah, so, they have a system.
So Barcelona is the Amazon of football teams.
If you want, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people will argue otherwise. Yeah.
I know, I think I understand why you like Barcelona, because Hagi used to play for Barcelona.
And Popescu used to play there as well. Yeah. I think he was a captain at one point. Yeah.
I agree with you. And a funny anecdote, we had a future lawyer conference last week, and the one of the keynote speakers, Andrew Arruda, we talked about it the evening before, and he put it into his presentation. We have an example from here in Norway. We had a coach called Drillo of the national team. Actually, the Norwegian national team sucks. Really, it's not a very good team. But under Drillo's management, it performed really well during the 90s, right? And we actually managed to qualify for two world championships, and we beat Brazil in 98. And actually, one point in 1993, Norway was ranked number two in the world, FIFA, really. That's it's incredible. And but we, you know, Norway didn't have the best team. But Drillo is a professor in football, and he studied the game and had a real good system for. So it's all about the system, and all the players knew exactly what to do, and they were handpicked to do actually that job.
That's actually
a very good metaphor as well, and like your Barcelona example.
That's exactly what needs to happen. So system was always going to beat individual talent, because otherwise, with individual talent, your system output is just susceptible to variables of any type. Once you start removing those variables, then it's going to be easier for you to manage and easier for you to improve. the job of a manager in general, and this is again something that a lot of people might not agree with me with, the job of a manager is to manage a system, not to manage people. People can manage by themselves, right? Everybody's grown up, and you hire them because they're good.
Yeah, and if you need to manage them, they're probably the wrong people, right?
Exactly. So if you need to manage people, you are either not the right manager or they're not the right people. But your management role should be to manage the system. Always ask yourself, how can I improve my system? How can I make my system better? Not how can I make, you know, Claudia better.
Well, you can think that too.
Yeah, you can always think like, how can I coach my people to become better employees? That's definitely something that you need to think of, but not how do I manage her activity?
A funny anecdote. Sorry about that. I mentioned it on my LinkedIn. It was this, you know, the narrative that you should always hire someone that's smarter than you. And then it was a cartoon, and one manager says that to his managers, and then one guy says, according to your theory, our CEO is the dumbest person in this company. I thought that was very funny.
I think it's funny, and that's actually very, very true. If you come to think of it,
yeah.
Analytically, if you come to think of it, that's probably true.
Yeah, but I agree with you, and it's not about being the smartest. It's about making room for people to thrive. Like, so you know, what can you do? How can you remove hurdles so people can actually do their job better?
Yeah, that's.
I totally agree with you. Sorry. So a lot of big companies talk about innovation, and we have the term innovation theater, right? A guy said that it's like lipstick. You just put lipstick on the pig. Yeah, exactly. Is that you work a lot with the companies, and do you experience that a lot, that their initiative actually are just innovation theater?
Some of the initiatives and some of the companies that I've seen are in just for the theatrics, if you want. I'm in general very selective with the companies I try to work with, because I'm very interested in working with the companies that want to do this for real. They want to move beyond post-it notes on the wall. There's actually a talk I give, and it's called Innovation Beyond Post-it Notes. And it's inspired actually by my colleague's Tendai's article called exactly that, Innovation Beyond Post-it Notes. Talking about innovation theater, a lot of people will ask, well, what is innovation theater, right? Innovation theater, in my opinion, is just doing something because it looks good, and not actually asking yourself, does that particular activity that you're doing have an impact on the bottom line or have an impact on your customer base? And if you allow me 5 minutes to talk about a metaphor, I'm always giving the metaphor of the cargo cult, right? So apparently this is a real story. In the 40s, during the war in the Pacific, the United States needed a resupply base for their planes and ships in the middle of nowhere, basically in the middle of the ocean, to have ships come in, resupply, restock, and then either fly back to the US or fly to the theater of operations. And obviously those islands were inhabited, and the US Army actually started employing those people. Very, very underdeveloped society, if you want. They haven't seen technology or anything like that. So they are still hunting with bamboo sticks and whatnot. And they were very amazed by the fact that they were seeing destroyed planes or destroyed tanks coming in with the evening plane, leaving the following morning. And then the following evening, there was a new tank coming. They didn't understand how things were made. They just understood the theatrics, if you want. So they saw airmen on landing strips doing, you know, the gestures on, like, on the airport, right? When you guide planes. And what was very interesting is what happened after 45, after the end of the war in the Pacific. And what happened is the US had absolutely no need for those islands any longer. And they totally pulled out of those islands. What's really interesting is even today, right, in 2018, there are still the Aboriginal population of that island. marching to these abandoned landing strips every morning and every evening, lighting up fires and mimicking the gestures of the U.S. airmen, because they think this is how medicine and food and supplies come in. They
really?
They don't understand how medicine is made, like the advancements that society needed to have in order to have medicine or food. They just understood the theatrics of it. They just understood the gestures that the airmen were making. So in much the same way, if you apply this theory to or this concept, if you extrapolate and apply it to corporate innovation, you're going to realize that a lot of people just create a very fun environment, like with ping pong tables,
beanbags,
right, with post-it notes.
Yeah.
Why? Because they go to San Francisco, they go to Tel Aviv, they go to Berlin. And the only things they see there was, these companies are very innovative. And I'm making a causal relationship in my head between the degree of innovation that these people are able to produce and the fact that they are wearing those sneakers and they have those beanbags and they use those post-it notes.
But is it really that simple? Do you really think that that companies are thinking like this?
I think that the most of the companies were at least till this moment in time, there were a lot of companies that created those labs just to mimic the labs of the companies or the startup labs that they've seen in those major hubs. Some of them matured, but they matured, you know, baptism by fire. They matured after having invested in those failed initiatives for so long, and they realized, oh my God, well, actually, no amount of beanbags is going to change my ROI. On the contrary, those beanbags cost, so they are going to be reflected as a cost in your accounting sheet.
That's a very good metaphor. And yes, it's what we would call when I studied method in statistics. I don't know if it's in English, but it's a spurious effect. Not the effect you think you see. Yeah. Like if you come home drunk one evening and you lie on the bed and you sleep with your clothes on and you wake up the next morning with a headache, you believe that because I slept with my clothes on, I have a headache.
Yeah.
You don't see the actual, you make a mistake on the casual causality of effects.
That's actually been a problem. You're actually confusing correlation with causality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, exactly. So we're going to then just one more thing. Innovation accounting. I think that subject is really important. It's, and I think it's probably the most vital point in corporate innovation. It's how you make sure your initiative doesn't get killed. Actually, right? So you have to have a system to actually make to measure your projects or your initiatives,
yeah.
So they can still be funded, even if they don't make a profit, right? But you need to have some certain metrics. Shortly, because this will be the topic of your speech at the shift. But shortly, what is innovation accounting?
Yeah, it's a thing that I've been very passionate about for quite some time now. So this is why we have a chapter in the corporate startup. And not just that, but I'm currently doing a lot of research on the topic because I think that it's a science that need to be evolved and developed further. I think innovation accounting is exactly that, measuring your innovation efforts. Because the problem is that core business metrics are not going to be able to measure in any good way your innovation efforts, right? If you are going to apply core business metrics to your innovation efforts, you're always going to be disappointed by all of your innovation initiatives. And whenever I'm on stage and talk with folks about this, I'm always giving the example of Usain Bolt. I have two images in the background. So I have Usain Bolt, setting up the new world record in 100 meters I think it was the Rio Olympics. And then next to him, it's Usain Bolt being 12 and winning his first medal at the junior championship. You can't compare young Usain Bolt with grown-up Usain Bolt. And in the same way, you can't compare your mature business with your startup businesses, right? Your investments that just launched yesterday, they can't be compared in any way to your mature business. So you have to have, as you have an innovation accounting system for your mature businesses, you have to have an innovation accounting system for your new businesses. It's very challenging, though, because a lot of the things methodology such as Lean Startup, which is probably very, very widely used in innovation, right? It's probably one of the most used methodologies in innovation. That methodology, like agile, like design thinking, they are cost avoidance methodologies. So they are not cost saving, but they're cost avoidance. And cost avoidance is actually more difficult to track than cost saving. Your standard innovation accounting, your standard accounting system, your standard accounting system is tracking the things that have happened. Good or bad, positive or negative, they're going to be tracked in your system. What's going to happen if you employ a cost avoidance system? Your cost avoidance system is just preventing stuff from happening. Well, where does that show up on your Excel sheet, right? Where does that show up in your balance sheet of the end of the month?
What do you mean by cost avoidance
system? So instead of saying, I have this great idea. I'm going to run 5 interviews or 10 interviews or do 5 experiments and see what happens. So after those 10 experiments, I realized that actually this would have been a big mistake if we were to found it, right? So instead of saying, look at the amount of money I brought you, I actually saved you that $500,000 that would have otherwise been spent on nothing because there was actually no customer need. So I avoided us incurring that cost. I avoid us from making that big mistake by doing small mistakes along the way. And by small mistakes, I mean experiments that failed.
Yeah. And design thinking is cost avoidance.
Design thinking is cost avoidance. Agile development is cost avoidance. Lean startup is cost avoidance. They're very well in the cost avoidance space.
Yeah.
So your innovation accounting system needs to be able to track your improvements of your overall ecosystem, considering the fact that that you are employing and you are deploying methodologies that prevent you from incurring cost. And of course, now we can go into the very nitty gritty details of that, and we can discuss, what are some KPIs? Well, it's very difficult to set up KPIs because they're very, very industry specific and very company specific. So I think you should use trends. You should decide upon which KPIs you're going to track and how are those being influenced or impacted by the deployment of certain methodologies or tools or certain activities. So the conversation now is growing exponentially, and it's not just growing in terms of vertical growth, but also horizontal growth.
Yeah, and I think this subject is, as I said, really, really interesting. And this is actually what we will focus on your presentation at the Shift.
Yeah.
Your research on this. And
my latest research, probably in 1 year, it's going to look different, but at least for the conference in November, I think it's in 3 weeks, right?
It's 3 weeks, yeah.
In 3 weeks, I'm going to focus on basically presenting what's my latest thinking on in the space of innovation accounting.
That's really exciting. At the end here, what are your favorite books that you could actually recommend to our listeners?
That's a very good question. I tend to read a lot, and I tend to read in a totally unstructured and chaotic way, which I'm not necessarily proud of. I think one of the books I read recently and was fairly interesting to me was Clarity First by Karen Martin. She's coming from lean manufacturing, so very, very systems driven, very manufacturing driven. But it was a very good book for me to open my eyes towards the other side of lean, right? So go actually to the root cause of the root source of lean, which was actually in manufacturing. Now I'm obviously reading a lot of stuff on accounting, because of the research I'm doing in the space.
Accounting.
Like real accounting, real accounting. And of course, also accounting in the space of lean manufacturing, right? So lean manufacturing accounting, because in lean manufacturing, going back to a bit to a conversation of accounting, lean manufacturing was promoting the idea of having no stock, right? Development on demand, so just in time development. Well, just in time development is going to take a toll on the number of assets you have on your books. Well, on one hand, it's good because your RONA is going to increase, right? Return on net asset. You have less assets. You have high returns. Definitely is increasing. But on the other hand, your company valuation is going to suffer because all of a sudden you no longer have those many assets on your books, right? So people will evaluate your company less than it actually is.
Yeah. And that's not a good thing, is it?
It's probably not good. Yeah, I don't know much about companies, but...
yeah. So, and the last question, what do you believe that that most people will actually disagree with you on?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I already mentioned one thing during our talk, and I said that manager's role is to manage a system, not a people. I think that you invalidated that because you agreed with me. I think another one is, and this is again, this is something a lot of people in core strategy hold very dear. I think that strategy is just macro level problem solving. It's just they're not that special, actually. They see a problem or they want to solve a problem in the company. What they do, they formulate a solution, and that particular solution is a strategy. Another thing that probably they disagree with me is the fact that their strategy is just a series of assumptions to be tested, right? And if we are able to validate, hypothesis at product team level, I think we should probably start doing that at strategy level.
And I agree in with you in that as well. So it's not valid. but yes, totally. And the strategy is nothing special, actually. But it's the problem is to actually, what's the causality here? You know, what will make us reach this goal? Yeah. What are actually the activities or the tactics that will make us? And that's not actually tested most often. It's just an hypothesis, especially in innovation, in normal execution, you have more, you could know more about what to do to actually reach your goals, right? But in like, unknown territory, it's much harder. Yeah. So innovation strategy, it's very, very hard.
Yeah, but again, we have the tools. We just need to start deploying those tools. Again, it's just assumptions that you have about the future. Well, let's just test those assumptions. I think that the future companies are going to be the ones that are able to do on a constant basis, on an institutional way, testing those going through strategy loops, right? Validating your strategy and then doubling down if it's proven right, or moving away to something new if it's proven wrong or disproven right. Treat your strategy as a series of assumptions, and then just treat them like that with your tools.
Everybody wants to do work at the innovative company, right? At least. What? Just very last question: how do you know if you are working at the right company or whether you should leave your company? What should you look for?
It's a very good question. First of all, I would personally ask people that face that dilemma if they are happy with what they do, and if they think that that's a place for them to thrive, succeed, or follow their ambition. If that's not the case, if they don't feel listened, if they don't feel that that's a place where they can be their very best they could be, then it's probably not the right company for them. It's very difficult to say what the right company is because it's very, very cognitive dependent, right? It depends on who you are as a person and what's your ambition.
Oh, okay. That answer was pretty broad. And,
sure.
But let's say in terms of innovation, like, if I want to know, am I really working in an innovative company that will actually make a footprint, or am I just working in, even though the job is nice, but I would like to know if this company actually is.
Look at the portfolio. Look at what the company is investing in. Are they investing only or solely in the core ideas, or do they branch out and invest in other areas, other domains, and not just invest, but do they invest with a clear vision in mind, right? Is that particular thing that they've invested in actually a one-time investment, or they've been consistently investing in growth outside of their core? And then you know if that's the right company to work for. And especially if you work in innovation department, it's very interesting to see what ideas are being backed. Are those the same old things being backed and being invested in, or they have a higher risk appetite, if you want, right? And well, problem at one point, my idea will be heard as well. It's just a matter of finding the right one.
I think that was excellent advice, Dan Toma, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about corporate innovation. And we're looking very much forward to seeing you on stage at the Shift.
I'm looking forward to that as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. See you later.
Thank you.